interesting, but I won't talk about them, but also of space-time symmetries. The well-known example is when we take a relativistic theory and go to a fixed point to scale invariance, to supplement the Poincaré group by scale invariance, then we get the symmetry is actually enhanced. So we get conformal symmetry out of that for free, which is much more powerful in the sense of, you know, classifying the states and the operators, in constraining the state and operator algebra of the theory. And it's especially powerful in two dimensions, where actually this conformal symmetry is infinite dimensional. Now, this statement that the conformal invariance follows from just scale and Poincaré, and unitarity actually, it has been proven rigorously, and actually the proof goes very, very, the proof is very simple. I'm gonna go through it fast on the next slide. It was proven rigorously in two dimensions. In higher dimensions, there is no rigorous proof so far, but there are no non-trivial counterexamples to the statement either. And recently there have been a lot of progress actually in the direction to proving, to providing here a rigorous proof. And there are now many evidence that this may be correct. Yeah, so the proof of the statement. So here there is a bit of algebra, but the proof is really, you know, amazingly simple. So go to light concordance. That's the argument is most simple in this light concordance, and consider correlators of the energy momentum tensor. Then just by the symmetries, by Lorentz symmetry and Della tensions, these correlators must have this form for different components of the stress energy tensor. This depends on coordinates. And then apply to these correlators, apply the conservation of energy momentum tensor. Then immediately, like applying this equality to this pair of correlators, we see immediately that this coefficient B must vanish. Yeah, because this correlator can depend only on a single light concordant. Okay, so B vanishes. Then at the next step, we apply the same equality to the second correlator, and then A vanishes. If A vanishes, that means that the two-point function of this component of the energy moment tensor is zero. And this component is nothing but the trace of the energy moment tensor. So basically, it means that the two-point function of the energy momentum tensor is zero. Then, inserting here the complete state of operators, we find that actually, yeah, and using unitarity, we find that actually any matrix element between vacuum and any state of this trace is zero. And then by locality, this is enough. So yeah, so this means that this state annihilates the vacuum. So then by locality, because this is a local operator, it implies that actually this local operator is identically zero. And here we are. So the trace of the energy momentum tensor is zero, and this is what we need actually for conformal invariance to construct these additional currents and infinite number of currents actually. So that comes really, it looks like it comes for free. Well, there is some subtlety which I skip here, that actually this the requirement that the correlators have this form, it assumes that dilatations commute with energy momentum tensor in a canonical way. So there are, which is in principle is not necessary. There may be additional so-called Schwinger terms, which are like total derivatives. But this addition, this problem can be eliminated if there is an additional technical assumption that the spectrum of dimensions is discrete. Okay, and yeah, another consequence of just this, you know, simple exercise is that actually T++ component of the energy momentum tensor depends only on a single light concordant. Yeah, that's actually clear from this two-point function already. That will be important for me later. So the question I'm gonna address is, can we make one step more and actually not assume Lorentz invariants? So is it possible to derive conformal invariance, including Lorentz symmetry, from just translations, dilatations, and unitarity? So here I should make a disclaimer. Of course, by scale invariance, I will mean isotropic scale invariance. Because of course, if the symmetry is non-relativistic, if I don't assume Lorentz invariance from the beginning, there may be systems where different coordinates scale in different way actually at the fixed point. So for example, time and space can scale in different ways, and which is parameterized by this critical exponent Z. So I will assume always that Z is equal one. Of course, yeah, of course, if Z is not equal one, the theory cannot be Lorentz invariant. So that's goes. Yeah, question. Okay, yeah, yeah, that's on the next slide. one more comment here, that actually the systems with Z greater than one, at least the simplest ones, they are liable to be unstable with respect to deformations towards Z equal one. So for example, take a scalar, a scalar theory with this part, which has a scale invariance with Z equal two, but now a relevant deformation of it, which includes only one derivative in the space direction, actually will drive this theory to a Lorentz invariant one in the infrared. Well, Lorentz invariant with an effective speed of light, of course. That's not always true. No, no, that's not very general. Actually, it would be interesting to understand where such deformations exist. Yeah, now, another counterexample, which was just mentioned, seems to be a counterexample, yeah, to the statement that I want to prove, is to take two theories, three scalars, with different speeds of light, which are decoupled, yeah? And it looks like there is no Lorentz invariance here, yeah? But in fact, actually, there is more than Lorentz invariance. There are two Lorentz invariances. because it's clear, yeah? Now I connect with one Lorentz group, I connect on the first of the first scalar and with the other on the second scalar. And actually, my the results that I'm going to prove is that this kind of represents a more general situation. So at the fixed points, you will get decoupled subsectors, each one having its own internal Lorentz invariance.
But this is not really more of a Lorentz invariance, because usual Lorentz invariance is not contained here. Meaning that the moment the two C's are different, there's no diagonal subgroup that represents.
There is no diagonal, but they don't talk to each other. And once I introduce interaction, the statement is once I introduce interaction, either they flow to a common Lorentz invariance or they decouple again, depending if interaction is irrelevant or relevant. So this was a non-interacting example. So now, what about interacting theories? And here, there are examples from condensed matter. And actually, it seems to be quite common phenomenon, condensed matter, at least for me as an outsider, that at low energies, there is an effective Lorentz invariance which emerges from something which is not Lorentz invariant in the beginning. First example is a theory of is 2 plus 1 dimensional QED, which seemingly describes many condensed matter systems, or at least used to model many condensed matter systems. This theory is, yeah, so in condensed matter context, it comes with different velocities for the effective gauge boson and for the fermions, and also actually even for different, you know, velocities of fermions in different directions. Dispersion, there are two species of fermions which have different velocities along x and y direction. Like dispersion relations have these elliptic forms. Rotated by 90 degrees. Now the statement is that in this theory, this is strongly coupled in the infrared. So it's not accessible well as it is to analytic, you know, study. But okay, one can do on large n expansion, so increase the number of these fermions. And that what people found is that really in the infrared, actually the anisotropy vanishes. So the fixed point, the infrared fixed point here is stable, and with this isotropy going vanishing, with the ratio of velocities going to one, and actually also the speed of this photon goes to the same value. Okay, so Lorentz invariance is emerging for free here. And actually, even also rotational invariance. Another example, which I found, but I believe actually there are many more, is the theory of graphene. Okay, I don't know how relevant it is for the real graphene, but again, what was studied is that take a honeycomb lattice of graphene and write the most general 4 fermion interactions, which are compatible with discrete symmetries of the lattice. Okay, there is like 6 possible couplings. Out of which 3 are also preserve accidentally Lorentzian symmetry, and 3 do not. The claim is that the 3 which are not Lorentz invariant are actually irrelevant. Yeah, then this system is analyzed in at one loop, and like fixed points are classified. So there is a trivial fixed point, of course, which where all these four Fermion interactions are irrelevant. I mean, free field point, fixed point, but there are also other non-trivial fixed points where, you know, these four Fermion interactions are important, but not all of them, but only three which preserve Lorentz invariants, and the others still are irrelevant. That was without gauge bosons, actually. The system with now, if we add the photons here, electromagnetism, there is another work which claims the following: that actually the speed of fermions go to infinity in the deep infrared if you start from instantaneous Coulomb interaction. If this instantaneity is cut by the speed of light, the speed of fermions go to the speed of light. Okay, there are also, I don't know. I'm not confident about that example, actually, but there is such a claim. And finally, this is the last example, which I think is most clean. It's the cleanest one. this is a theory of for me, this is a theory of fermions interacting with bosons. It's like Yukawa theory. Well, it seems that it's models. The physics on the edge of topological superconductors. On the edge, so it can be, if it's two-dimensional topological superconductor, then it's, the theory on the edge is 1+1-dimensional, or it can be 3+1-dimensional topological superconductor, then it would be a theory of on the surface. And again, it's the statement that it will be true also for 2+1-dimensional case, but what was analyzed in detail is 1+1-dimensional case. So now here, so this topological superconductor, so basically there is a plate inside the spectrum is gapped because it's superconductor. And on the edge, there are fermions. There are actually two phases. So there is a phase with almost free fermions propagating, massless fermions propagating on this edge. But there is also a magnetic order, which can either appear or disappear there. And if this order, magnetic, anti-ferromagnetic order actually establishes, then these fermions get a mass. So that's phenomenology of the system. And this can be described by, or modeled by, 1+1-dimensional fermions interacting with the boson, which is Ising model for this magnetic order. Now, a priori, the velocity of fermions and bosons can be different here. And and again, one can ask question: what happens if the theory is run into infrared? If the velocity of this guy converges to the velocity of this guy, okay. Again, the theory gets strongly coupled, so it cannot be directly treated. What was done in this work? It was put on a lattice, actually discretized and put in a lattice, and then analyzed on the lattice. So they found the ground state and computed various. Various observables. So one of them is entanglement entropy between different subsystems of this system. Yeah, and you see the numerical calculations are these red points, and there is also actually a theoretical curve here, which is probably not very visible because it's green. It's the usual problem with the green color, but actually it goes exactly through these points. And this curve is for tricritical Ising model. So in other words, it looks like the system actually flows to a tricritical Ising model. And there are various observables which coincide. Okay, this is one of them. And this happens even if the initial anisotropy difference between velocities of bosons and fermions is as large as 4. Yeah? There is a certain parameter in the lattice theory which stands for the ratio of the velocities. And the system still flows to the same fixed point, which is actually not only Lorentz invariants, it's also supersymmetric, like critical Ising model. Yes?
The relevant operators
there is time reversal symmetry here. Is it enough to protect you from the relevant operators?
Only one, which is R. So they have to choose one parameter.
The parameter is
still for this. So this, even though spectral critical Ising, it's actually an ordinary critical.
that was one of the points of the papers.
Yeah. Okay, so now the general argument actually that the fixed infrared fixed point, Lorentz invariant infrared fixed point actually will be stable. Again, actually the argument is amazingly simple. So yeah, and I don't know who first put this argument actually forward, because it seems like it isn't, you know, like really known, or like some people seem to know it from their, you know, almost birth. Some do not know it. For some people, it's very surprising. So just to be on the safe side, I don't put any reference here. So, so the argument goes like that. Consider a relativistic series. So we are, assume that you are already at the fixed point, at a relativistic fixed point. And assume that this theorem that scale invariance implies the conformal is valid. So we are at the conformal fixed theory. Now we study its stability. So we want to perturb it by various operators. So let's try to perturb it by an operator which breaks Lorentz invariance. Well, this must be some component of some tensor of that theorem. Okay, for simplicity, let me concentrate on the case where I don't break the rotational invariance, so that this must be a time component of a tensor, of a symmetric tensor. Well, actually, the argument goes even if we relax this assumption. Yeah, but then you can rewrite it. Okay, then you can redefine the metric. You can absorb this delta ij into redefinition of the you know, space coordinates. So it will, you can trade delta j for zero zero component. And now in unitary CFC there is a bound on dimensions of such operators. So the dimension grows with the spin, with the number of indices. And here we are. All operators with spin greater than 2 are automatically irrelevant, so they don't matter. And then we just should worry about operators with lower spins. Okay, there is one marginal, exactly marginal operator with spin 2, which is an energy momentum tensor. But adding the energy momentum tensor or component of an energy momentum tensor exactly, you know, amounts to the definition of the metric. So it's, it does not really break Lorentz invariance. It just, you know, renormalizes the speed of light. Well, maybe accidentally there may be other exactly marginal operators with dimension 2, with dimension d, with spin 2, but that's, well, that's quite highly improbable, yeah, because they must correspond to a conserved, to some symmetry, because they are conserved tensors in that case. Well, though, as I understand, in 1 plus 1, actually, that may happen in some, you know, supersymmetric series. Okay, so the only, well, so, okay, it's fine. All operators with spin larger or equal to 2 are okay. And then the only danger are actually vector operators of dimensions in the window d minus 1 and d. And yeah, they can break Lorentz invariance. That's true. That's actually a good example. A well-known example is a chemical potential. So we had an operator which is a zero component of a conserved current, and it of course leads us to something which is non-relativistic. But on the other hand, they may be absent if the theory has additional discrete symmetry. So these vector operators are very easy to forbid with discrete symmetry such as time reversal or charge conjugation or CPT. And they may be absent because of these reasons. So basically what we learned so far. So we learned that Lorentz invariant infrared fixed points are attractive in the infrared. So they have some finite basin of attraction. So means that there is a, if I start from an arbitrary theory, and there is non-zero probability to get into an infrared fixed point, to a Lorentz invariant fixed point. Yeah, so there is a certain, you know, region in the parameter, fundamental parameter space of the original non-relativistic theory where I have a chance to get there. Yeah, additional comment here that strong coupling, if the theory, if this RG flow is strongly coupled, then running will be actually fast. So this anomalous, yeah, that's basically, oh, sorry. Well, that basically relates to the fact that these operators which perturb away from Lorentz invariance in strongly coupled theory generally gets large anomalous dimensions, or large dimensions, different from one. So then this flow would be power law, and this Lorentz invariance would emerge as a there will be a power law correction to Lorentz invariance if we are close to the fixed point. Then, of course, there is an option, there is a possibility that fixed points might have scaling, anisotropic scaling, with critical exponents different from one. And these are, of course, not Lorentz invariants. So this is another option. And finally, logically, there is an option where I do have isotropic scale invariants at the fixed point, but don't have Lorentz invariants. So this must be far away from this situation, but okay, still, logically, it is allowed at this point, at this stage. So basically, the main result which I advocate today is that this option is ruled out. So it's impossible to have scale invariant theory without Lorentz invariants, or many, or several Lorentz invariants. Of course, it's ruled out up to some assumptions, which I'm gonna list now in detail. So the statement. So let's go through the assumptions. I consider local field theory in 1+1 dimensions, which has translation invariants, and locality is encoded in the fact that I assume that these translations are generated by local energy momentum tensor. Okay, I will call it energy momentum tensor, but of course I don't assume Lorentz invariants at this point. Okay, there is just like four. Maybe it's, the proper word would be energy momentum complex. But okay, I will use this relativistic terminology. Just otherwise, I will be screwed up. in general, it's not symmetric. So there are these four component tensor, but in general, it's not symmetric. If it were symmetric, I would get Lorentz invariants already. the theory has positive Hamiltonian. It's unitary. And invariant under these isotropic dilatations. I assume that these dilatations are generated by a local current. There is a local dilatation current which generates these transformations. Now, by general, general form of this current is that it must contain a piece which depends on the energy momentum tensor and contracted with coordinates. This just corresponds to coordinate transformations.
Hamiltonian. Is there a Hamiltonian, a positive Hamiltonian?
Yeah, the eigenstates of this Hamiltonian all have positive energies except the vacuum, which has zero energy.
But so zero Hamiltonian has negative energy.
No, but if it quantizes properly,
that's exactly what I'm asking. How do you define it?
Well, I have a Hilbert space, and then I have this operator acting on it, and that's it. So for Dirac, it would be that I start from the Dirac C, yeah, right? then the dilatation invariance is one of the assumptions that the dilatation operator commutes with the momentum in the appropriate way. So the energy and momentum have dimension one. Okay, then there is this technical assumption that the theory must possess diagonalizable spectrum of scaling dimensions, blah, blah, blah. Yes. It's in real space, so I will be working in Lorentzian signatures.
There's no unitary bound on the dimensions at this point?
No, I'm not using anything. and then the last assumption, the physical assumption, is that I need some, you can call it pre-relativistic structure. Well, it's actually not relativism yet. It's physically, that's a requirement that signals propagate with finite velocity. There is a certain upper bound. So they may propagate with any velocity, but it should not exceed some value. And mathematically, it's encoded that in the requirement that all local operators commute outside certain causal cone. Yeah, it must be exactly zero. So well, if it's fixed point, it will be exactly zero. Yeah, if it's.
But like Lee Robinson bounds are not.
I don't know. Actually, it may be enough. I haven't studied that. Yeah, that's a good point. This assumption, it's needed at certain technical steps, and maybe it can be relaxed to something less restrictive. Questions about assumptions? Are there? Okay, not. then the statement. The statement is then the energy, so first in words, then the energy momentum tensor splits into a sum of independent EMTs. So what does it mean? It means that energy momentum tensor is represented as a as a finite sum of certain, again, tensors, which have the property that each of them is conserved separately. They commute with each other, and each one of them is symmetric in the sense, actually, that all components are proportional to each other with some coefficient. So, these are like basic relations. They imply, in particular, that among other things, they imply that each of these tensors is traceless and symmetric in the sense that XT and TX components are related, linearly related to each other. So that means that, let me go to the next slide. So yeah, what does it mean? It means the following, that I can immediately, because of the symmetry property, I can immediately construct additional conserved currents like that, which generate Lorentz boosts, yeah, each one of them, with the speed of light, with some speed of light, VA. And because also there's it must follow automatically from the fact that I have a Lorentz invariance and scaling symmetry, it follows that each of these products is promoted to the full conformal group, yeah, by the Zamolodchikov theorem. So it means that each of these tensors, or partial energy momentum tensors, generate a product in a full conformal group. It generates a full conformal group which enters as a product in the full symmetry.
So one of those assumptions was used somehow that this VA will be smaller than the maximal V?
Yeah, that will follow, yeah. Well, no, what was used, that actually there is this maximal V. Otherwise this V...
So automatically becoming less than that limit?
Yeah. So what the structure, what it means? I mean, what is this? Actually, that's quite unusual that we have several control. Well, it's not that unusual. So let's consider explicit example, yeah, simplest example. So if you have just one product here, this means that this corresponds just to standard conformal chiral theory, conformal field theory, conformal chiral field theory. Because each product here is either left or right, it's this full decomposition. So if additionally parity is assumed here, it's pretty easy to show that the two eigenvalues, the two velocities, will be different just by the sign, and this will correspond to the usual CFT, yeah, kind of where we both have a right and left left moving and right moving sectors. In general, I have more sectors, right? So in general, I have a structure where I have n sectors. So let me separate those operators in the full operator algebra, which is huge as usual. Let me take those operators which transform non-trivially under, say, first conformal group and trivially under the rest. Okay, this set is not empty because I have at least energy momentum tensor there. So then this set will form its own conformal theory. That's easy to show because it follows, yeah, it follows from the commutator, from the commutation property of this between these different EMTs. So I can construct out of these partial EMTs, I can construct partial energy momentum operators. So I can construct this P1, which will act non-trivially by translations on the operators from C1, and will leave invariant all the other operators from all other families. So that means that in the OPE of the operators from this sector, there can be no operators from other sector. So these operators form a closed operator algebra. So there will be these subsectors, each one being a conformal theory, and then there may be something on top of it. In fact, yeah, like, and actually there must be something. For example, the products of operators from different sectors will be somewhere here. But important that the operators from different sectors, they won't be interacting in the sense that if I just take operators from here and if I take an arbitrary correlator with operator from here and from here and from here, it will split into product of correlators over every over separate sectors. Is it? Yeah, let me write it. So if I take a correlator with a bunch of operators from the first sector and operators from the second sector, it will split into a product of the two correlators. Yeah.
You could imagine taking one of these theories and gauging some discrete symmetry to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but gauging meaning adding interaction between them. Yeah, but that will be.
So to preserve the fact that the stress tensor is a sum.
Yeah, I think you are talking about operators that can live. There might be operators on top living here. No, but with these ones, I think it won't spoil this factorization property. Why do you think it can change anything here? Well, the argument actually is like that. Again, I take this correlator, I can act with, maybe you break, by this orbital function, you may break this translation invariance, no? Don't you break it?
No. Well, it depends on which sectors don't just not everything back, like the partition factor.
Well, partition function maybe not. Well, it won't factorize. No, that won't, because I have also this this C on top of these islands, around these islands, the C of operators here. So no, then it won't factorize. Well, I may have this. It would completely factorize if I would be able to prove that any operator from the C is a product of operators from these islands. But in general, that's impossible. Here I agree. Okay, now, yeah, so maybe more questions about the statement before I go to the proof. So. Okay. Then I will try to go to sketch the proof. And it goes into three steps, which are supposed to be easy, but as usual, it's not the case because like here, okay, the first step may be easy, but the rest is usually not that. So that's what happens here. So the first step is actually indeed very easy. So starting to make the puzzle, you just put it on a table, and the first immediate thing that can be done is to render the full energy mount tensor traceless, just from the conservation of dilatation current, there is this relation between the trace of the operator and the trace of the energy mount tensor and the divergence of the virial current, and then it's trivial to improve this energy mount tensor in such a way that it becomes traceless, but not symmetric maybe at this point. Another almost as trivial step as the first one, as this one. Well, it's actually not even step, it's sub-step in my notations, the transformations of energy momentum tensor can be brought to canonical form, that the dilatation transformations of the energy momentum tensor can be brought into canonical form so that it becomes you can call it a primary operator under, well, not primary, not, of course, well, not primary bad word. Okay, it transforms as it should as an operator of dimension 2, as a local operator of dimension 2. This uses this technical assumption of discreteness of the spectrum. Now things become much more complicated. So the next step is based on the following idea, that let us go back to the relativistic case and think what is the structure of the spectral density of the energy momentum operator in Fourier space. And because of this property that energy momentum tensor, its different component depends only on a single light cone coordinates, the spectral density is localized completely on the light cone in the Fourier space. And in particular, it vanishes inside the light cone. So the goal of the second, the second step is to prove that actually this property, this vanishing inside a certain light cone or causal cone, persists also if the theory is just scale invariant. So this is the property of scale invariant, actually, not of Lorentz invariant. And again, like pictorial idea that in 1+1, it's actually, there is kind of direct mapping between real space and core and momentum space. Just if something vanishes inside here, must vanish inside here, like it's 90 degrees rotation. But well, actually, that go okay. This was pictorial idea. Okay, then there is algebra, which again probably I just try to sketch. Of course, the relevant object to study in this context is the commutator, which encodes the causal properties. Yeah. So we take commutator first over the vacuum. The vacuum average of the commutator, express it using the spectral density here, and in any unitary theory, the spectral density must be positive, definite. Also, due to the scale invariants, it has actually a very simple form. It must depend in this way on the arguments. And then we just plug it into the requirement that we just take it and plug it in the formula, yeah. And because of this nice form, the integral over frequency actually can be taken. It factorizes out. And what we are left is the integral over frequency can be taken. It produces a delta function, actually a third derivative of the delta function. So we get this relation. So indeed, the spectral density in the momentum space, yeah. So recall, this originally dependent on momenta. It is directly related. Well, it gets as an argument, it gets something from the coordinate space now. So there is this really direct mapping between points of the momentum space and. Yeah, and the real space. Okay.
So you assume that there's a scale invariant normalizable vacuum.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So you assume that there's a discrete spectrum of operators.
So yes, okay. And there is a vacuum, and it is a scale invariant. Yes. okay. So we got that this third derivative vanished. Of course, it's not yet enough to prove that the whole thing vanishes so far, because okay, it's just third derivative which vanishes. But then we recall the restrictions put by imposed by the conservation of the Angerman tensor, and actually again this relation I obtained just by acting with derivatives on the operators entering into this formula, and it turns out that the spectral densities of various components that are related by these identities, and you see here. So we find that the spectral density of Tx component is actually proportional to the spectral density of Xt component with a factor, x to the fourth. So there is an additional factor. So now, if this now vanishing of this of this quantity implies actually that the spectral density itself vanishes, because it must be proportional. If it doesn't vanish, it must be proportional at least to the fourth power of the argument. So now it vanishes. And then by unitarity, again, inserting, the complete, by unitarity. The unitarity tells that in any unitary theory, this thing must be positive, yeah? And if it's zero, that means that this operator annihilates the vacuum. Now, in this case, that's not actually enough. Unlike the case of the Malachikov theorem, that's not enough to argue that this Fourier component vanishes on its own, because it's not a local operator. So far, only a certain subclass of matrix elements vanishes. And in fact, we need to prove that it it annihilates not only the vacuum, but any state. And here, it becomes even a bit more messy. But again, the idea is to go to a thermal bath now. This is an observable which is sensitive to all states in the spectrum, in the Hilbert space. And again, there is a spectral density entering here. There is a spectral representation for the thermal commutator, thermal average of the commutator. And again, there is a statement that this thing must be positive in any unitary theory. And if it's not positive, then the operator vanishes identically. And also, it has a nice property under time reflection. The argument goes more or less as on the previous slide, but in that case, it also involves integration over the whole light ray, and here where the subtlety, there is a real subtlety, because well, this commutator is not a function. If it were just a function, of course, I can integrate it over any, you know, over any direction. But it's a distribution. And to make sense of this integration along a light ray, one really have to go and analyze what happens at x equals zero. Actually, the singularity is the origin. But actually, using precisely this causality property, it can be shown that there is a certain distribution. If it's multiplied by x to the third, it becomes a well-defined distribution in one variable. And then I can do whatever I want, like Fourier transforms and so on, and actually arrive to the same conclusion. Well, to the conclusion that this integral of the spectrum density must vanish, which then, again, using the conservation of the Angelman tensor, implies that spectral density itself vanishes. Yeah. Okay, so now the things become much easier, and we just need to put all the pieces of the puzzle together. So the third step is to construct, actually to explicitly construct these partial EMTs. And this is done by, so first I construct a chain of operators which have this property that the time derivative of the previous operator is the space derivative of the next one in this chain. This chain starts from the components of the energy momentum tensor itself. Of course, the time derivative of TTX component is TXX. Yeah, which is equal by tracelessness to the energy density, TTT. The derivative of TTT is TXT. And then I just need a derivative. Now I take time derivative of TXT, and it doesn't look like a space derivative of anything. So I want to restore equality here. And construction of this chain will mean that actually this amounts to construction of additional conserved charges of dimension 2, so of the same dimension as the Angelman tensor. So basically this, okay. By diagonalization, this can be brought in this canonical form, which I presented before. But okay, let me explain why I needed why I went through all this trouble with the spectral densities of the Angelman tensor. So basically, okay, so well, let's consider this matrix element, the average of T of the integral over space of TXT component over an arbitrary state, normalizable state, whatever. then doing Fourier transform, I arrive to this equation, and here precisely where this is the first place where this property of the spectral density enters. Yeah, because I have proved that this spectral density vanishes everywhere inside the light cone. So in particular, it vanishes at any zero momentum, unless frequency itself is zero. So this is a localized integral, localized at zero, and it can be proportional only to a delta function. Well, here again, there is a possibility in principle to have derivatives of delta function, but that would produce a growing matrix element, growing with time, like a power law. Which cannot happen, well, physically again, because of finite velocity of signal propagation. Because by rewriting this matrix element, I actually can cast it in this form. It's like dipole moment of energy over the state. And because the state was localized and expands only with finite velocity, this dipole moment cannot grow faster than linearly with time. And then this matrix element must be bounded. Well, actually, it can be shown also in a more rigorous way. This is constant, yeah. So if this thing is proportional to the delta function of omega, then the whole integral doesn't just depend on time at all. So this is a conserved current, a conserved charge, and then I can construct. Okay, once it's conserved current, I can construct the corresponding x component of the current just explicitly by this formula. And it is a local operator because, that's a local operator because now if I take a commutator of this operator there is this operator and there is kind of string attached to it, and I take a commutator of this guy with any other operator. Okay, if this operator is on the right from this phi 4, okay, then it's clear they commute. But if this operator is on the left, I just flip the string to the other side. It's like Dirac string. I can flip it because the total integral is zero. yeah, and also the spectral density of this new guy is related to the spectral density of the Angerman tensor by multiplying with this factor. And that's again where it's important that I actually proved the spectral density vanishes inside the whole light cone, because then this is a well-defined object. Otherwise, it could be divergent. Okay, then we continue construction of these operators by induction. And I had an assumption that at the level of dimension two, there is only a finite number of operators. Okay, that's another technical assumption. So that this chain closes, actually. And then, so we have this chain with this property. Then we can define, we can interpret this, you know, this transformation as a map inside this the subspace, the linear envelope of these operators, and diagonalize this map. So at the end, we arrive to eigen, you know, eigenstates of this mapping. So when I take time derivative of an operator, I get its space derivative. So they're just related with some real positive that real non-zero eigenvalues that can be shown as well. And the original operators are expressed as linear combination of these ones. So basically, so in particular, we get we get that the components of the Angerman tensor are sums of these operators, which I now identify with these partial EMTs. So here they are. And by construction, they are traceless, symmetric, and conserved. One more thing has to do is to prove that they commute, which actually is important. Let me not go through that. They can be used, can be done using Jacobi identities. So that's, here we are. So questions? Just let me add some speculations. So of course, it would be interesting to generalize this statement to higher dimensions. Yeah, okay. The 2D is fine, but is interesting, is very good. But it would be interesting to have it, to understand if it's possible to do something similar. Yeah.
The assumptions, there are no vector operators with dimension between 1 and 2?
No, it does not. No, this fixed point may be unstable. Actually, it's any fixed point. Okay. Can be UV, IR, doesn't matter. It can be unstable. So that does not by itself imply. Now, in higher dimensions, so it may be difficult. Well, the first reason is that already in 2D it was not that easy. So recall how easy it was to prove conformal invariance and in 2D, and in 4D it had not been done yet. So now it was in my case it was not easy already in 2D. So boom, maybe in 4D it seems like to be out of reach. Well, but a more substantial actually reason is that there is a simple counterexample which. Which is counterexample to the statement, at least in the way that it was formulated before. So take, in 2 plus 1 or 3 plus 1, take a vector which has only space components, just by default. And then preserving rotational invariance, I can write two different gradient terms for it. In this case, the longitudinal and transverse degrees of freedom will propagate with different velocities. And though it's a non-interacting theory, there is no local transformation which would disentangle these two. But still the theory is free, so there may be a hope that maybe with proper additional requirements, in particular with proper formulation, that the theory must be interacting. There may be still some analog of the statement which I presented. So here new ideas are needed, apparently. Okay, and here's the summary. So thank you. No.
It's just phonons, right?
Why do you think so? No, I mean, there are contributions both from here and this C are arbitrary coefficients. So Yeah, it's really like phonons increase, actually.
So, I have a question. So, one, I guess you were assuming translation variance, but if you relax that, you have disorder. Then CFTs can genetically be very unstable.
If I have disorder, sure. No, translation variance is 100% important. Yeah.
But also, disordered fixed points can be extra stable sometimes.
Yes.
So I don't know if you thought of this at all.
What is your point?
I'm just asking if you thought about
disorder. How disorder affects this? No, I have not, but I think it will destroy it. I think without translation variance, you cannot tell much.
That's the kind of pessimistic view, but I think there may be some reason to be slightly more optimistic.
Yeah, also. The first problem that appears is that to formulate actually scale invariance. Yeah, in my case, scale invariance was basically the requirement of commutators between translations and dilatations. So there is this algebra, small. So in case of breaking translation invariance, I have to postulate something else, which I don't know what. Might be interesting.
I think what he means is that you put in locally break translation invariance, but then there's an emergent translation invariance in the disordered theory.
Okay.
Long scales.
Okay, so then
those theories are usually non-unitary.
Okay, that's a different story, yeah. Okay, I see.
Good questions. Let's thanks again.